Hello and welcome to the October 2012 podcast from Le Monde Diplomatique. My name is George Miller, and each month I bring you an in-depth interview with one of our contributors. This month, my guest is a return visitor to the programme, Chase Madar, a civil rights lawyer based in New York, who earlier this year published The Passion of Bradley Manning, the story of the suspect behind the largest security breach in US history. Chase's article in this month's Le Monde Diplomatique is entitled Land of the Ever Less Free, and it looks at how, under Obama, America's security state apparatus, rather than being rolled back, as his campaign promised, has in fact been significantly augmented. So today, the federal government employs 30,000 Americans to monitor the phone conversations of their fellow citizens. And last year alone, Washington classified 92 million documents, almost double the number made secret just 2 years before. When I spoke to Chase on the phone earlier this week, I began by asking him if we had been naive to believe Obama's campaign promises, such as the closure of Guantanamo and the repeal of the 2001 Patriot Act.
In retrospect, it's clear that we were terribly naive in expecting a rollback on the overweening national security state that had developed even further under Bush and Cheney after Obama took power. Part of this expectation is based on the historical precedent of the rollback of the national security state after Vietnam and Watergate, when in the early to mid-70s you had a very energized, emboldened Democratic majority in Congress that successfully trimmed the powers of the CIA and the FBI, and there were powerful inquiries and committees that looked into the abuses both at home and abroad of the national security state. There wasn't much that President Ford, a rather weak Republican president, could do about it. And many of us expected the same kind of course correction and reining in of an unaccountable security apparatus after Bush and Cheney. But we read the political weather patterns wrong. I think such a correction is only possible when you have a Republican who's weak in the White House and a strong, energized Democratic majority in Congress. Once a Democrat takes over the executive branch, however, you can forget about any kind of course correction. Democrats, it seems, only care about civil liberties when they are in the opposition.
So was that what stopped Obama? Is that your explanation for why he couldn't push through with those things?
Part of why he couldn't push through those things, there are many reasons. First of all, no U.S. president has been fully in control of the national security apparatus since Dwight Eisenhower, who was, of course, the supreme Allied commander in Europe with great experience in the military, and he had nothing to prove, and he was not easily pushed around or manipulated by the intelligence agencies, by the military. Second, any president who would control the national security apparatus would need, I think, great political skills to do so. And Obama plainly lacks this kind of political adroitness and ability to manipulate. And third, any president to do so would have to have the political will to control and rein in the national security state. And Obama is plainly lacking this too. And he's plainly lacking this because he never really had that strong a mandate to trim the abuses, to hold torturers accountable, to bring civil liberties back into the picture. This is, unfortunately, a real minority concern in the U.S., and there's no political price for Barack Obama to pay by ignoring these civil liberty concerns. People who care about civil liberties, no matter how bad Obama fails them, are not going to turn around and vote for Mitt Romney. So there's really no price to be paid by shafting these concerns.
Now, you use the phrase the normalization of domestic security, and I wondered if you could just sketch a picture of the ways in which that security state has developed since the Bush-Cheney years.
Well, Obama, instead of cutting back and curtailing the excesses of the Bush-Cheney years, has developed them further, often adding a layer of legal oversight, which is not particularly meaningful. But here's some examples. Guantanamo, instead of being closed down, has just been modified. There's been a slight correction in the tribunals there, but they're going on right now. without huge modification from the Bush-Cheney years. The president has now taken on the power to assassinate U.S. citizens abroad with only the flimsiest of legal oversight. How meaningful this legal oversight is very, very debatable, but it's a huge erosion of civil liberty rights. Also, the National Defense Authorization Act has horrible erosions of habeas corpus, a very old ancestral right in the U.S. and the U.K. For holding people without charges, but that's possible now, too. And Obama, in typical fashion, had expressed some misgivings and had some hand-wringing reservations while he signed it, but they're still in that bill. And meanwhile, the whole national security bureaucracy has continued to expand in a cancerous fashion. You still have this building boom in Washington, D.C. area, where you have 33 building complexes adding up to 17 million square feet being built since 9/11. And Obama has added to this building complex with a $2 billion data surveillance center in Bluffdale, Utah. There are 30,000 people currently monitoring data, phone calls, emails in the United States. This is clearly a real threat to our civil liberties here.
I mean, you make the point that the Department of Homeland Security is the third biggest U.S. government department. And yet the article also brings out the fact that it is, I mean, you used the word cancerous, it is like something which is growing virally without any single controlling intelligence with oversight of the whole thing.
That's right. It's been growing explosively and with very little oversight, certainly no centralized oversight. There's an excellent book by two Washington Post investigative journalists, Dana Priest and William Arkin, called Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State, that outlines this in great detail. The growth of these national security bureaucracies, instead of solving the intelligence problems that helped make the September 11th attacks possible, I think it's only magnified them. The major problem we had leading up to September 11th was a failure of security bureaucracies to be able to communicate with each other. There was a lot of bureaucratic opacity. For instance, the FBI had detained someone who was clearly going to be the 20th hijacker in Minneapolis, St. Paul, but they had to let him go even though there was good information that this guy who was taken in on a immigration law violation, was up to something. But instead of streamlining the national security bureaucracy, simplifying it and enabling communication, we have only thrown money and billions and billions of dollars to expand all these competing bureaucracies that really don't work with each other at all, that don't communicate with each other very well. And in theory, there is someone who's in charge of all of them, the Director of National Information. But in actual practice, this cabinet-level position wields very little power. And instead, we just have the same problems magnified.
And it's got to the situation where, I mean, it's a rather ridiculous situation, where nearly a million people in the U.S. have top-secret security clearance. And that almost makes the notion of top-secret meaningless, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. When 850,000 people have top secret security clearance, it does force the question, how secret is this? What on earth does this mean? Why not make most of that information public? And we've had the expansion of classification, and everyone in Washington admits that there is a huge problem in over-classification of important government information. Last year, Washington classified 92 million documents. We are not going to make well-informed decisions as a public, as a nation, if we have, if we're deprived of important facts, which is how it is today. And that's part of what led us into invading Iraq, too, a poorly informed decision without knowing all the facts.
Now, you made the point earlier that there aren't really votes to be won in closing down Guantanamo, but why is there so little public opposition to the advance of the surveillance state in general?
Well, it's quite chilling how, over the past 4 years, public support for Guantanamo, for torture, and for many counterterrorism so-called measures that probably would have been condemned under Bush and Cheney, public support for these measures has grown why is this? One thinks of the United States as a very libertarian-minded nation. We think of ourselves here as the land of the free. Freedom is a word that's used in all kinds of contexts here. It's an important part of the national self-image. But it turns out that much of this freedom talk has to do with property rights rather than privacy rights. The Tea Party movement, which is vocally, vociferously anti-government and blames all the problems of our country on Washington, you would think that they might turn against this overweening growth of the national security state. But they have been largely silent about it. And the great majority of the Tea Party-affiliated members of Congress voted to renew the Patriot Act, have voted to escalate the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And part of this cuts to the whole nature of what freedom has meant in the United States. Full citizenship with all the rights and freedoms that entails has not historically been across the board in the United States, but it's been very tribal with a core of white men who trace their roots back to England, Northern Ireland, and Scotland, enjoying full citizenship. And these freedoms and rights only expanding gradually and often with great violent struggle to other groups, to black people, to women, to American Indians, to immigrants. And unfortunately, you see that there are limitations to freedom, despite our endless talk about it here.
Is the Department of Homeland Security such a huge juggernaut now and traveling at such a thunderous pace that it really doesn't matter who wins the election next month from this point of view?
No matter who wins the election next month, you're not going to see a huge drawdown or rise in accountability in the national security state apparatus. Without endorsing either candidate, I can think of some advantages. Now, if Romney wins, you're likely to see an emboldened Democratic opposition about civil liberties, because Democrats do make noises about civil liberties, at least when they are in opposition. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if Romney wins, you are much more likely to have war with Iran. And one thing that history teaches is that foreign wars inevitably lead to harsh clampdowns on civil liberties in the name of security at home. I don't see a happy outcome. The only candidates who are promising some accountability and some control over this out-of-control national security apparatus are rather marginal. Ron Paul, who was running for the Republican nomination, ultra-conservative, but also anti-imperialist, and in many ways very civil libertarian. You have Gary Johnson, the conservative Libertarian Party candidate. He's a former governor of New Mexico. And then you have Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. Now, these are all marginal figures. Unfortunately, they're locked out of the presidential debates, which is a shame because they would add some valuable perspectives, because really Romney and Obama are quite as one when it comes down to things like drone strikes, Guantanamo, domestic surveillance. Romney has said that he has promised that he would be much looser about torture, which is deeply troubling, and there is a difference there. But overall, the differences between the two when it comes to the national security state are minor.
I was talking to Chase Madar. You can read his article, Land of the Ever Less Free, in the October 2012 issue of Le Monde Diplomatique. Do also visit Le Monde Diplomatique's website at mondediplo.com. There, subscribers can read the current issue of the paper and access a complete archive, as well as explore the Diplomatic Channels section, which offers articles, blogs, maps, images, and a podcast archive dating back to 2008. I hope you'll join me again next month for another in-depth interview with one of our contributors. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.